to find out where the story goes. Sat hip to hip with the curtains closed, watching ourselves, oh cinema.
If film is merely the study of life, then film theory is simple philosophy. It's time for Real Lessons, that's R-E-E-L, with KUVO's Andrew Craig. Twice a month, we're going to analyze a film to see what life lesson it contains.
Today, we're going to look at Amy, the recently released biopic of the late iconic jazz vocalist and contemporary musician Amy Winehouse. The film, directed by Asif Kapadia, is an archaeological treasure that traces the origins, evolution, and gradual extinction of Winehouse and her musical brilliance. The film begins by ushering viewers into an ordinary scene, the 14th birthday party of one of Amy's friends. Amy and two friends sit on a stairwell while the birthday girl holds the camera.
My 14th birthday evening and party.
Yes,
sir.
It doesn't take long to distinguish Amy's voice from those of the others. When you watch the film, you also recognize the performance talent in her movement and facial expressions. Less noticeable are the three lines of weighted text that tiptoe in and out of the frame. The first line reads, 1998, the year the video was recorded. The second line reads, Southgate, the neighborhood in which the house is located. The third line reads, London. The text is color-blocked in yellow, white, and orange so as to stand out from the moving image beneath it. The name of the birthday girl wipes across the bottom left side of the screen in thin white font. The text lasts only a few seconds, and our gaze promptly resettles on the shot's visual action. So what's the big deal? Let's fast forward a few minutes.
My friend Tyler is a singer. He was with Nikki Shemansky, and Tyler said, my friend Amy sings jazz and she's great. And Nikki said to me, do you want some studio time? And I said, for what? He was like, well, if you write songs, we'd make a record, get a record deal. I was like, what do you get out of it?
This scene comes 3 minutes into the film. Once again, the text is heavily weighted and color blocked. As the film continues, we discover that this stylized coloring dominates most of the text on screen. Dates and the names of performance venues appear in a medley of colors: green, yellow, blue, purple, orange, and red. The color imbues the text with a performative agency, and the text visually conveys emotion. The text is a character in the film just as much as any person. If we focus on the appearance of the text during the full length of the film, we can categorize it into two families based on color tone: warm colors and cool colors. Altogether, the colors serve as narrative precursors for the scenes that follow. Consider this.
We met in a pub in the Good Mixer in Camden. I was at the bar and then she came in. We just sort of started playing pool and we went to another pub. And then we went back to Amy's house. She was seeing somebody else and I was seeing somebody else. But I don't think of it as infidelity. I just thought she was like a young girl and she was a bit naughty. And I was the same.
In this scene, Amy meets Blake Civil Fielder, the man who introduced her to heroin. To communicate a sense of premonition, the name of the club where Amy meets Blake appears in red text. Throughout the film, the text mostly serves as a visual synecdoche for Amy's life. Through its varied colors, moods, and shapes, the text represents the drama of Amy's experience. There are two exceptions to this textual stylization. Sometimes the dialogue in the film becomes unintelligible. During these moments, text promptly appears in a plain white font at the bottom of the screen. The other exception is the names of interview subjects, which consistently show in a plain white font. So why do the details of Amy's experience display in colored text, whereas the names or identities of everyone else appear in white? Through coloring the details of Amy's experience, the film asserts Amy's individuality by graphically demonstrating the degree to which she was different from everyone around her. Her difference was, in effect, a form of isolation. Today's real lesson is that individuality is a function of isolation. The degree to which we are true individuals reflects our capacity to disconnect from our environment and render ourselves unique. This thought evolves into a paradox upon considering whether or not true individuality can ever be expressed or recognized through any shared language. If the measure of individuality is isolation, how then do we express our true, unique selves? Furthermore, what societal and/or linguistic structures limit the expression of our true selves? We could certainly dive into discussion about whether or not true individuality actually exists, but that would be material for an entirely new real lesson. Until then, I'm Andrew Craig for KUVO.